The following audio is from the series, The Bible's Big Story, an Old Testament introduction and survey. For additional teaching resources and to learn more, visit teachingthetext.org.
So we continue our survey through the Old Testament. This morning we'll be looking at the book of Ecclesiastes. Looking at the wisdom books over the last few weeks. So I'm looking forward to this morning. Ecclesiastes is a sort of a neglected treasure, I think, within the canon of Scripture. It's often viewed as difficult, as challenging. And so I think it's much neglected in both public teaching and also in private study. A lot of people we read through it in your annual Bible reading, but I don't know of too many people who, when you ask them what book of the Bible they're studying or really spending a lot of time in, Ecclesiastes usually isn't one of the ones that gets mentioned. When we're pressed for time, it's a lot easier to turn to the Gospels or to one of the Psalms for scripture reading or for sermon preparation. But those who are willing to apply their hearts to understanding, as the text says, for them the blessings are enormous. So the book of Ecclesiastes seeks to apply wisdom to one of the great questions that has plagued humanity, and that is, what is the meaning of life? And as if this question were not difficult enough on its own, the way that Ecclesiastes answers that question is also hard for us to grasp sometimes. In a way, the approach of Ecclesiastes is exactly the opposite of what we looked at last week in the book of Proverbs. Proverbs, as we saw, dispenses wisdom with short, memorable answers that are very to the point and very condensed. That is not the book of Ecclesiastes, for the most part. It has some Proverbs in it, but the approach of Ecclesiastes is to wrestle with the answer through a prolonged, really book-length treatment that forces you as a reader to grapple with all the nuance and complexity surrounding this question. And so it's only in carefully reading and considering the book as a whole that the answer is finally revealed. So let's look at some of the introductory information this morning, and then we'll get into the book. The title of the book, the Hebrew name, it comes from it's a feminine participle of the verb which means to assemble or collect or gather together. And so elsewhere in Scripture, this word refers to one who gathers together or speaks to an assembly of people. So one who gathers, one who addresses the assembly. And so because of this, many English translations often translate the word there as preacher or teacher. And so you'll find it there at the very beginning of Ecclesiastes, talking about who this is, and the name is mentioned elsewhere as we go through. It's also, I think, probably a play on words, referring to someone who not only speaks to the gathered assembly, but someone who has gathered all of this wisdom and is now communicating it to his gathered hearers or readers, as the case might be. Now, the Septuagint, the Greek translation of the Old Testament, translates this Hebrew word into a Greek word with an equivalent meaning. And so that Greek word in the particular form there, ekklesitos, means one who is a member of an assembly. That may sound familiar because it's very similar to the same word, just in a different form, ekklesia, which is often translated as church in English translations. And so the English title then, Ecclesiastes, is just an Anglicanized pronunciation of that Greek title, translating the Hebrew word meaning assembly, or one who gathers together an assembly. As far as authorship goes, like so many others that we've looked at recently, the book of Ecclesiastes is anonymous. It simply identifies the author or references the author in verse 1 as being the preacher, the son of David, king in Jerusalem. But there are some clues about the author's identity in the text. And the majority of both Christian and Jewish tradition throughout history has viewed Solomon as the author of the book of Ecclesiastes. That's far from certain, however, and there are some even conservative believing scholars who disagree with that view. For instance, that attribution there as the son of David, the king in Jerusalem, immediately makes us think of Solomon, especially in the context of just having read Proverbs. However, that could really apply to any of David's descendants who sat on the throne in Jerusalem. But along with being the son of David and the king in Jerusalem, there are other parallels between Solomon and this figure, the preacher. In chapter 1 of Ecclesiastes, he is described as having unique wisdom. In chapter 2, he's described as having unsurpassed riches and great wealth and many servants. And in chapter 12, he's described as someone who has written many proverbs. And so all of those things certainly would fit with seeing Solomon as the primary author. Personally, I find Solomon's authorship plausible, but the ambiguity of the text means that we should not be overly dogmatic in our opinions about that. Because ultimately, regardless of who the human author of Ecclesiastes is, the reliability and truthfulness of the text rests on its divine authorship, not on our ability to figure out who the human author was. And this is alluded to in the book of Ecclesiastes itself. In chapter 12, the book acknowledges that this wisdom is given from one shepherd, which I think is a reference to God himself. And so we might do well to heed the wisdom of a 3rd or 4th century, rather, Christian teacher that you've probably not ever heard of, a man named Didymus the Blind. If you're familiar with church history, he was a contemporary of Origen, Athanasius, and so on, around the time of the Second Council of Constantinople. But he wrote a commentary on the book of Ecclesiastes, and speaking of authorship, he said, "Actually, the Spirit is the author of the divinely inspired scriptures. The Spirit inspires so that words are expressed, but the wise man is also involved. For the Spirit has not himself invisibly written the letter and put down the text, but he breathes it into the soul. Either the real author is Solomon or some other wise men have written it. Maybe we should opt for the latter so that no one may say that the speaker talks about himself." So Didymus there recognizing the ultimate issue is divine authorship and then acknowledging whether it's Solomon or someone else is not really relevant to the truthfulness of the text at all. As far as the dating, how we date the book of Ecclesiastes is, of course, connected directly to its authorship. So if Solomon is the sole author of the book, then it has to have been written in the 10th century BC during the time of Solomon's reign. Solomon reigned from about 970 to 930 BC. However, if it was written or if it was expanded upon by another, as we'll see, there's sort of an introduction and a conclusion. And so the way that it's written leaves open the option that someone has sort of compiled this and given an introduction conclusion. So if it was written or compiled, expanded by another, then the dating could be as late as the 5th century BC. As far as the theme and purpose of the book, a key to understanding the theme of Ecclesiastes lies in rightly understanding two primary terms that are repeated throughout the book. I'll address the first one now, and then we'll talk about the other one a little bit later on as we get into the lesson. So the first term that we find throughout Ecclesiastes that I think is essential for understanding the theme and meaning of the book is the phrase, "under the sun." The writer often talks about things that happen under the sun. It appears 29 times in the book, and it's describing the setting of Ecclesiastes. So it's informing us what the author's addressing, what setting he is looking at, where he's applying this wisdom, where he's performing this inquiry. It's under the sun. So it's referring to this current realm of human life and experience and perception. In other words, he's talking about what happens in this life on this side of the grave, in this physical world in which we inhabit. And so by using this phrase, the author limits his perspective to that, but he also simultaneously expands it in the sense that he applies this wisdom and experience to every location and every era of history. So he's not just speaking or applying this wisdom to his own time period or to whatever nationality or country or region that he lived in, but he applies it to life under the sun, which of course covers the whole world and all of human history. So as I mentioned at the beginning, the purpose of Ecclesiastes is to answer the question, what is the meaning of life? And in order to answer that question, the book presents two contrasting viewpoints. So as we go through the book, you'll see these two viewpoints sort of going back and forth almost in a conversation in the book. The first and most obvious one sees the emptiness or vanity of life on earth from a merely humanistic or naturalistic point of view. This is the perspective that takes up a large portion of the book, and this is why many of the things that are said in Ecclesiastes may at first glance sound inconsistent with what we find elsewhere in biblical revelation. So we have to read carefully and understand which perspective is the author speaking from as he's sort of having this back and forth dialogue as we go through the book. The second viewpoint that we encounter in the book is a God-centered view, which, by pulling back the veil, reveals the source and meaning of life as something, the life on earth, and it points to something outside of this natural realm. So the first one shows the futility of life apart from God. The second perspective finds its transcendent meaning in knowing God. And so the whole book is really a conversation between these two. Life is brief for everyone, regardless of their relationship with God. But ultimately, it's only a life that is devoid of relationship with the eternal and transcendent God is judged to be truly meaningless. So it's only empty, it's only vain, it's only meaningless when we fail to recognize it as a gift from God and live in light of eternity. So as we always do with this, we try to summarize the theme down into a brief statement. So the theme summary for the book of Ecclesiastes is this: reflecting on the meaning of life under the sun exposes the futility of all human pursuits and achievements when viewed apart from God. True fulfillment is ultimately found only in a covenant relationship with Him. Therefore, fear God, appreciate His simple daily gifts, and keep His commandments. All else is vanity. That's how I would sum up the book of Ecclesiastes and its message in one brief statement. All right, any questions or comments on that section before we move on? Always like to give opportunity because it's kind of a fire hose of information there at the beginning. So if something wasn't clear or didn't seem consistent, let me know. All right, let's move on then to look at the structure and overview of the book itself. Because of the nature of the book, which admittedly at times resembles a rambling conversation with a wise man more than a carefully arranged lecture, the structure of Ecclesiastes is a bit hard to nail down. And you'll find this out really clearly if you start digging into it and looking at the opinions expressed by various commentators. If you read commentaries on Ecclesiastes in parallel, look at the way that they outline the book and side by side, you'll notice, oh, these some books of the Bible, they're almost identical. There's a little nuance, but everybody basically breaks them down the same way. And then you have others like Ecclesiastes, where the way that they break down the structure varies quite a bit from person to person. And that's usually a sign that the book is a little more difficult and the structure is not quite as clear and on the surface. So as usual for this class, I've tried to keep it simple by dividing the book into four parts, which are then enclosed with an opening, prologue, and epilogue. So opening, closing, prologue, epilogue, and then four parts in the middle. In the first part, in the prologue, really it's just the first verse the compiler or editor introduces this one who's speaking throughout the rest of the book, this preacher or teacher or assembler of the people, this Ecclesiasticus that's talking here. And then beginning in verse 2, all the way through chapter 12, verse 18, we have this character, this speaker, using these two views to set out and persuade the reader of his premise. So he begins right after that opening prologue with a poem that considers the vanity of life under the sun. And then in this first half of this middle section, the speaker describes his search for meaning in the vanity of this life. The second half of the middle section, beginning in chapter 7, there's a subtle shift from a perspective of search and inquiry, which we see mostly in the first half, to one more of dispensing wise counsel for life under the sun. And then as we go through this whole section, throughout this entire center section, there is this alternating pattern. And I put this up here just to kind of help visualize it. I didn't put the reference numbers in there because it was just too small and too busy, I think, to see well at distance. But there's this alternating pattern of inquiry and wisdom. And so as you walk through here, you'll have this pattern of observation, And so he'll state some things. These are what I've seen. This is what I've observed. And then that will be followed by a short passage of wisdom, a sort of commenting or drawing wisdom out of that. And that pattern is repeated all through that middle section. So the first part, focusing on the search and the inquiry. The second part, focused on dispensing wisdom. But there is that back and forth pattern that continues all the way through. And then finally, the book ends with another poem. This one considering aging and the vanity of moral life. And then finally, the editor adds a conclusion and a final summary of the book's perspective in the last few verses of chapter 12. So that's a breakdown of the structure of Ecclesiastes. Now let's walk through it in our remaining time this morning. We'll look briefly at each one of these sections, starting with the prologue in chapter 1, verse 1. Oops. The first section consists of only a single verse. Chapter 1, verse 1, it identifies what follows as the words of the preacher, the assembler. And this prologue, like the epilogue, as I mentioned, could be by a second hand. Or it could simply be a literary device. So Solomon, or whoever the author is, could be the only one writing here. And he could write this introduction, speaking of himself, introducing himself, and then speaking as the preacher, and then concluding, referencing what he has written. Authors do that today, and that's certainly a plausible explanation for what's happening here as well. And then in the second section there, we have that first poem that really opens the book after that opening attribution. The words attributed to the preacher begin and end with the phrase in chapter 1, verse 2, "Vanity of vanities," says the preacher, "vanity of vanities, all is vanity." And here it is just put forth without any explanation, sort of teasing out its meaning and purpose then through the rest of the book. So this phrase serves as, I think, a sort of motto for the discussion to follow. And one of the reasons that I think this is not only because it's right at the beginning, but also because it's repeated again at the very end, at the end in chapter 8. And so when we get there, in chapter 12, verse 8, the very end of that section. And so, sure why those aren't filled in, but there we go. So the phrase that we find in 1-2 here is then repeated at the very end of the last poem. It opens the beginning poem, it concludes the last poem. So it really forms this bookend, this parenthesis around the whole book, this exact phrase. Vanity of vanities, says the preacher, vanity of vanities, all is vanity. And the Hebrew word here that's translated as vanity is the second term that I mentioned. So I told you there are two terms that I think are essential to understand in order to sort of wrap your head around the message of the book of Ecclesiastes. The first one is under the sun, to know what he's referencing, where he's applying this wisdom. The second one is this word translated here as vanity. When rendering this word in English, the translators face a problem. And that is that there is no single English word that precisely matches the range of meanings found in the original underlying Hebrew word. And so they're forced to pick a word in English. But whichever word they pick, it's going to lose some of the nuance. Because sometimes in a different language, those of you that are bilingual will understand this, there's words that have a range of meaning, and you're like, well, it means this, and it can mean this and this, and I can think of an English word that covers this part of it, and an English word that covers this part of it, but there's no one English word that grasps the whole possible range of meanings, and that's the case with this word here. So although vanity or emptiness certainly captures part of the meaning, it's not a one-to-one correspondence. Because we typically think of vanity as something meaningless or useless. However, the underlying Hebrew word here also expresses the idea of something that is insubstantial or temporary. And so I think a slightly clearer English equivalent for some of this might be breath or vapor, something that is temporary, that is transient, that's there, but it's sort of insubstantial and it's momentary and then it's gone. And it's important to keep both ranges of meaning in mind. Because something with a brief or temporary existence is not necessarily meaningless or useless. So this life and its experiences are temporary, and in light of eternity, they are brief. However, the question of whether or not they are meaningless remains to be answered. That is the question that the writer is wrestling with. So the repetition here in of this word vanity of vanities, all is vanity, the repetition of that word is a way of emphasizing that Hebrew idiom of linking a singular noun to its own plural as a way of expressing a superlative idea, of saying this, it's as vain as it can be. It's an emphasis. And so the poem picks up this opening statement, all is vanity, and then it carries it forward by examining the temporary nature of existence in the natural world. So in this poem in chapter 1, it begins in verse 3 by asking, if all is vanity, then what is gained by life? It goes on, verse 4, human lifetimes come and go while the world continues on. Verse 5 to 7, everything in the natural world is an endless cycle which continues on and on. And then he concludes in verses 10 and 11 by acknowledging that nothing human is either permanent or new. And so this opening poem then is an apt introduction to this first main section, which is all about seeking for meaning in the vanity or the toils, the temporariness of this life. And in this section, the author examines various avenues by which men seek meaning, and after pursuing each one, he judges them as vanity. So this, in this search for meaning, he sort of goes on this quest, and he's like, all right, I'm going to go this direction. I don't know where this is found, so I'm going to head east. He travels east for a while. He's like, nope, it's not here. So well, now I'm going to go west. I'm going to try that. And I'm going to, okay, I didn't find it that way, so I'm going to go south and see if it's in that direction. You can sort of picture it in your mind like that. Except instead of going on a physical journey, he's going on a philosophical and theological journey going through this. And so he pursues a number of avenues. And the first one that he pursues is knowledge. He begins his investigation with the pursuit of knowledge, seeking to answer this question through gaining information and applying understanding. And so in chapter 1, verse 12, he says, I, the preacher, have been king over Israel and Jerusalem, and I applied my heart to seek and to search out by wisdom all that is done under heaven. It is an unhappy business that God has given to the children of men to be busy with. So he says, I've applied my heart to seek out all the wisdom that's done under heaven. I'm going to, by gaining knowledge, by learning, by understanding, by seeking this out, I'm hoping to find meaning to this life that has been given to us. And this is the author here. He describes his efforts at an intentional search, but he concludes at the end in verse 14, I have seen everything that is done under the sun, and behold, all is vanity and a striving after wind. All is temporary, it's insubstantial, and it's like striving after wind. I like that picture better than the older translation, vexation of spirit. I think once again it grasps the meaning better. It's like chasing the wind. Did you ever do that as a kid? Wind blows, try to catch it. Try to run faster than the wind. You know, it's fun for a moment, but it's, to use the term of Ecclesiastes, it's vain. It's meaningless. You don't ever catch the wind. It's there and it's gone. And that's was his assessment of pursuing knowledge. He continues his search down the path that most take, beginning in chapter 2, looking for the meaning of life in pleasure and in the acquiring of possession. So chapter 2, verse 1, I said in my heart, come now, I will test you with pleasure. Enjoy yourself. But behold, this also was vanity. And so right at the outset, he lets us know the result of this search. And this was not simply a reference to mere hedonism. As if you read through that section, many of the things that he mentions, the pleasures he pursued, include things like constructing buildings and planting gardens and doing things, you know, to better life in many ways. However, he soon finds that all of that also was temporary and vain, and it did not last. So he says in verse 9, so I became great and surpassed all who were before me in Jerusalem. Also my wisdom remained with me, and whatever my eyes desired, I did not keep from them. I kept my heart from no pleasure, for my heart found pleasure in all my toil. This was my reward for all my toil. But then I considered all that my hands had done, and the toil that I had expended in doing it, and behold, all was vanity and a striving after wind. There was nothing to be gained under the sun. And so ultimately, even though he admits that he enjoyed the toil and the labor, when he got to the end and he looked at it all and he's looking, remember that question, he's seeking meaning in life. When he looks at it as the source to provide meaning for his life, He sees its temporary nature and he realizes it's completely inadequate to fulfill that longing, that desire for meaning in life. And so the search continues. Beginning in verse 12, this time he sets out to follow the paths of wisdom and folly. He says, "So I turned to consider wisdom and madness and folly. For what can the man do who comes after the king? Only what has already been done. Then I saw that there is more gain in wisdom than in folly, and there is more gain in light than in darkness." At the end of this search, he acknowledges that there is a value in wisdom over folly. However, he recognizes that ultimately both the wise and the fool in the end suffer the same fate. In the end, death overtakes all. So in verse 16, he says, "For as of the wise and as of the fool, there is no enduring remembrance, seeing that in the days to come, all will have been long forgotten. How the wise dies just like the fool. So I hated life, because what is done under the sun was grievous to me, for all is vanity and a striving after wind." So once again, looking at wisdom, he recognizes a benefit in it. But ultimately, when he comes to find the meaning of life in merely acquiring and gaining wisdom, he finds that that too falls short. Because at the end of life, even the wise die just like the fool. They end up in the same place. Death equalizes. It comes for both. And so he sees that too in its own self as being vain and empty for answering the question of meaning to life. And then for the remainder of this first section, he considers the pursuit of gain in all of its forms. Ultimately, however, he concludes that everything we work hard for is vain because it will eventually be enjoyed or squandered by another. In verse 18, he says, "I hated all my toil in which I toil under the sun, seeing that I must leave it to the man who will come after me. And who knows whether he will be wise or a fool? Yet he will be the master of all for which I toiled and used my wisdom under the sun. This also is vanity." This also is temporary. It's insubstantial. It's not something to build a foundation of meaning for life upon. Even if I'm hugely successful and build a great empire and houses and all of this and a business and all of that, and I pass it on to somebody, how do I know how well they're going to handle it? How do I know what's going to become of it, what's going to be made, whether good or ill later on? I have no control over those things. So as something to base the whole meaning of my life on, ultimately even that falls short. In the last three verses of chapter 2, he pulls back the veil, giving us our first glimpse of the other point of view. Remember, I said he's arguing from 2. He's been arguing from this purely naturalistic, just looking at things under the sun. It's all empty and vain. And now he shifts the focus from this life to God in chapter 2, verse 24. He says, "There is nothing better for a person than that he should eat and drink and find enjoyment in his toil. This also, I saw, is from the hand of God. For apart from him, who can eat or who can have enjoyment?" And so we get the first glimmer of the answer here. He's beginning to see that he's beginning to look for something beyond this life, something other than just what is found here under the sun. And changing our focus from an earth-centered one to a God-centered one brings clarity. We do not find ultimate fulfillment in earthly life because that was never the purpose of life on this earth. Life is simply a gift from God to be enjoyed and not an end in itself. And so in chapter 3, he begins with another poem, which could be titled "A Time for Everything." Probably a pretty familiar passage to you in the book of Ecclesiastes. And he continues this thought that concluded the previous section, emphasizing the diverse experiences of life. "For everything there is a season and a time for every matter under heaven, a time to be born and a time to die. A time to plant and a time to pluck up what is planted. A time to kill and a time to heal. A time to break down and a time to build up." And so on. And this poem recognizes that life in this fallen world comes with an allotted menu of both positive and negative experiences. And which of the two views that are arguing back and forth in this book, which of those two views you take will ultimately determine how you view those experiences. If we pull back the veil, we will see that they are more than just random chance events. They are specific times and seasons that God Himself has set. He has a beautiful purpose in them, even though we cannot sometimes see it at all. And so he concludes after the end of that poem in verse 9, saying, "What gain has a worker from his toil? I have seen the business that God has given to the children of men to be busy with. He has made everything beautiful in its time. Also, he has put eternity into man's heart, yet so that he cannot find out what God has done from the beginning to the end. I perceive that there is nothing better for them than to be joyful and to do good as long as they live, and also that everyone should eat and drink and take pleasure in all his toil. This is God's gift to man." So the value of labor then is not determined by what is gained from it, or by what is left over from it when we are gone, but whether or not we have taken full advantage of the experience itself. So if we apply this wisdom to life, then we will not judge our efforts based on how well they pay or how great a contribution they make to society. The preacher acknowledges that even those things will soon pass away like vapor. But instead, wisdom acknowledges that all of our work, even the ordinary and the mundane everyday things, are a gift of God's providence. And viewing it this way should encourage us to be faithful and diligent in our labors, not for what we gain from them, but that by pursuing them faithfully and joyfully, we take good advantage of the gifts that God gives us and we bring glory and honor to Him. So throughout the rest of this section, chapters 3 to 6, the author comments on injustices he has seen, how the poor are oppressed and the rich by the rich and the rulers. And yet in the end, once again, both the poor and the powerful and the wealthy, they all meet the same fate. His assessment of this is that it's all vanity because they are all striving after wind. And so in light of this, he enjoins both the poor and the rich to fear God and to enjoy the life that he has given them. Chapter 5, verse 18, "Behold, what I have seen to be good and fitting is to eat and drink and find enjoyment in all the toil with which one toils under the sun, the few days of his life that God has given him, for this is his lot. Everyone also to whom God has given wealth and possessions and power to enjoy them and to accomplish or accept his lot and rejoice in his toil, this is the gift of God. For he will not much remember the days of his life because God keeps him occupied with joy in his heart." And so then he sort of concludes that first section. He wraps it up in the last few verses of chapter 6. After examining each of the areas, he finds each one fails on its own to provide the meaning of life. And he recognizes that this failure ultimately stems from one thing. All of these things have a common failing point, and that is the limits of human knowledge. So at the end of chapter 6, he says, "For who knows what is good for man while he lives the few days of his vain life, which he passes like a shadow? For who can tell man what will be after him under the sun?" None of those pursuits, none of those aspirations that he examined can bring or give true meaning because we cannot know how they will ultimately turn out or what will become of them after we are gone. And so because of this, what appears meaningful now and important and substantial now may prove with the passing of time to be fruitless and empty. And that's why as he examined each one of these, he had to admit it's vanity, it's vapor, it's like a breath. And that's sort of the conclusion of that search in the first section as he comes there. He comes to the end of that and he says, happened to click through those to get them to appear, and I went one too far. There we go. He comes to the end, and he has not answered the question, and he recognizes that at the heart of the problem is the lack of man's ability to understand and to know the end of things and what will come after him. And then in the second section, wise counsel for life under the sun, that pattern of observation and wisdom continues, but the overall tone shifts from examining the meaning of life to dispensing wisdom for living under the sun. And so he begins with another section of poetry at the beginning of chapter 7. This time it's in the form of a list of proverbs. And one thing that all the proverbs at the beginning of chapter 7 have in common is they're all better than statements. We talked about those last week as a type of Hebrew poetry. Another common feature is that each one of these proverbs is a form of wisdom reversal. That is, they state something that is the opposite of what we might think or expect to be. So a couple of examples from the beginning. Chapter 7, verse 1, a good name is better than precious ointment. That sounds plausible. And the day of death and the day of birth. Well, wait a minute, that doesn't seem to make sense, right? We tend to rejoice much more in the birth of a baby than in the death. That seems to be something that's bad and mournful. But he says here, on the day of death is better than the day of birth. He goes on, it's better to go to the house of mourning than to go to the house of feasting. Well, that definitely is the opposite of what we would expect someone to say. For this is the end of all mankind, and the living will lay it to heart. So as you go down through there, you'll notice that each one of these better than proverbs at the beginning sort of turns what you might expect on its head. The temporal things of this life cannot satisfy because God has put eternity in the heart of man. So for every man living under the sun, this temporal mortal life is not the end of existence. Everyone will live somewhere forever. We are created as eternal beings, and our time in this life is only a part of our eternal existence. So eternal satisfaction cannot be found in these temporary things, but only in the eternal God. And so in conclusion to all of this, he says that both joy and adversity are from God. So chapter 7, verse 14, he concludes that section of Proverbs by saying, in the day of prosperity, be joyful. In the day of adversity, consider. God has made the one as well as the other, so that man may not find out anything that will be after him. So both joy and adversity, he acknowledges, are from the hand of God. They are given at God's sovereign hand, and they are not meaningless. They are not vain and without purpose, but rather he gives the purpose there that man may not find out anything that will be after him. Why is that? I believe that what he gets at, and this is fleshed out better later in the book, is that the purpose in this, God's purpose in doing this, is in order to foster dependence upon him. He allows us to experience both the good and the bad, and to not know which one's coming next or which way things will turn out, so that we will look beyond this life under the sun. So that we will look beyond the sun to find meaning. We will recognize that we must find the source of our meaning. We must be dependent upon him. We must look at something other than ourselves, other than the things in this life, to find meaning and purpose for our existence. And so then he teases this out a little bit more in the sections that follow. The primary reason that men struggle to know what path to take is because they do not know the future. That knowledge belongs to God alone. So he goes on in chapter 9 to say, but all this I laid to heart, examining it all, how the righteous and the wise and their deeds are in the hand of God. Whether it is love or hate, man does not know. Both are before him. This is an evil in all that is done under the sun, that the same event happens to all. Also, the hearts of the children of men are full of evil, and madness is in their hearts while they live, and after that they go to the dead. So ultimately, death comes for all. Young and old, rich and poor, slave and free, death is the great equalizer. So in verse 11, he says, again, I saw under the sun the race is not to the swift, nor the battle to the strong, nor bread to the wise, nor riches to the intelligent, nor favor to those with knowledge. But time and chance happen to them all, for man does not know his time. Like fish that are taken in an evil net, like birds that are caught in a snare, so the children of men are snared at an evil time when it suddenly falls upon them. So all of this, the hardship, the difficulty, we cannot know, and death is the greatest example of this. It comes, we cannot foresee it coming. We look to the end of life. We all like to think that we have a very long life and that death is somewhere off in our 80s, 90s, beyond. But we don't have that guarantee. You know, I have friends that I grew up with that are not here now, that died many years ago. Some of them when they were still children. They did not have that promise. And so we do not have that certainty. We do not have the ability to look forward and to see. And so considering this, then the wisdom that the preacher offers in conclusion is that men must simply live with this lack of knowledge. In Ecclesiastes 11:6, he says, in the morning, sow your seed, and at evening, withhold not your hand. For you do not know which will prosper, this or that, or whether both alike will be good. So the wisdom that he gives us in understanding this is not, let me tell you the secret to understand the mind of God and all the plans and to know the future. No, his wisdom is, guess what? God has not given it to you to know the future. And so therefore you need to live diligently within the light of that understanding, that you must live with that lack of knowledge. Therefore sow your seed. Therefore take those chances, try those opportunities, trust them to the hand of God. But don't hold off on things because of that lack of wisdom and of knowing the future. And then finally, he concludes the book once again with a poem mirroring the beginning of the center section. We have one more section of poetry at the end, beginning in chapter 12. And this time the poem is a reflection on youth, aging, and the vanity of mortal life. In this poem, he admonishes the reader to remember God before his brief life is past. So, life is brief. You can't know the future. You can't know what is ahead. That's all in God's hands. All you can do is live the life that God has given you. And then his conclusion there with that closing poem is, therefore, remember God before this brief life is past. Give a thought to that. Look to something beyond and outside of this life. To know God is life's greatest pursuit, and it is the only one that has eternal value. So that section, part of it in chapter 12, remember also your Creator in the days of your youth. Before the evil days come and the years draw near. I bumped that. Is it back on? There we go. I was afraid my battery died. I think I just bumped it. Now, before the evil days come and the years draw near, of which you will say, I have no pleasure in them. Before the silver cord is snapped, or the golden bowl is broken, or the pitcher is shattered at the fountain, or the wheel is broken at the cistern, and the dust returns to the earth as it was, and the spirit returns to God who gave it. So remember the Creator in the days of your youth. And then he has this poem describing the death that is coming, cord that snapped, the bowl that's broken, all of that, the dust returning to the earth, the end of life. That comes, he's already said, death is that inevitable thing that's coming for all. It's that great equalizer. And so, what must we do? Remember your Creator. Know God. That is life's greatest pursuit. That's the only thing that ultimately matters, that's not vain in the sense of being transient, temporary, and passing away. And then he concludes this final poem in verse 8, on the same note that he began the opening poem back in chapter 1, verse 2. Vanity of vanities, says the preacher, all is vanity. Now this conclusion has puzzled some, as it seems that he has reached the end of his discourse with nothing having changed. Seems like he ends up in exactly the spot he began. He started out saying everything's vanity, and then after all of this investigation, after all of this wisdom, he gets to the end and says everything's vanity. And you think, well, What happened? But don't misunderstand. This is not fatalism. He's not just saying, well, there's nothing we can do. The search is, there's no answer. Remember the nuance and the meaning of the word translated as vanity. It refers not just to meaninglessness, but to something that is temporary and brief. And so if we read this final statement in light of the book's entire message, then we can grasp its meaning here, especially in light of the poem and on mortality that comes right before it. Life is vain or temporary. It's brief for all, regardless of whether they have a relationship with God. However, it is only a life absent a relationship with the eternal and transcendent God, which is truly meaningless. And so I think it's a play on the double meaning of that word there. Yes, everything is vain. Everything is temporary, but not everything is meaningless. And it depends on whether you take to heart the message of the book, especially what's communicated in that closing poem there about remembering the Creator in the days of your youth. That sort of makes the determination, yes, everyone's life is vain, but is your life vain just in the sense of being temporary and it's short? Or is it actually vain in the sense of being meaningless? Well, that really depends on whether or not you have found meaning and purpose in the transcendent God. So in other words, life becomes void and empty only if we fail to see it as a gift from God and to live it in light of eternity. And so then the conclusion in the end of chapter 12. Beginning in verse 9, final verses of chapter 12 form a sort of epilogue to the book. And in them the editor praises the wisdom of the preacher. And then he offers in verses 13 and 14 a final summary restatement of the book's conclusion. So if you were confused when you got to chapter 12, verse 8, and you didn't understand the conclusion there, he sort of clarifies it for you at the end. This is too long didn't read at the end, a short summary statement. Chapter 12, verse 13 and 14. The end of the matter, all has been heard. Fear God and keep his commandments, for this is the whole duty of man. For God will bring every deed into judgment with every secret thing, whether good or evil. So the conclusion to the whole matter, what is left for us to do? It's not, let me tell you the secret to know the future. Let me tell you the secret to know which path. No, you're not going to know. Yes, life is brief. Yes, you don't have control over those things. But what is it? God has given you this. He has arranged things in this way so that you will look to Him for dependence. So in the end, how we find meaning in life is fear God. Keep His commandments. This is the whole duty of man. It's not build up a great retirement account. It's not become a celebrity and become famous and well known. It's not to be able to, you know, retire somewhere and fish for the last 20 years of your life. If you like fishing, that's great. That's not the goal and the meaning of life. The whole duty of man, the whole purpose, the whole goal behind it, whatever avenue you take, whatever thing comes by the Lord's sovereign providential hand, whether good or ill, whether riches or poverty, whatever, ultimately we all have at the core the same meaning, the same purpose, the same call, and that is to fear God and keep His commandments. So now let's look in our remaining few minutes this morning at how redemption is revealed in Ecclesiastes. Do this for each of these books of the Old Testament. As Jesus said, they all point us forward to Him. We find that the overall trajectory of the Old Testament is pointing us forward through redemption. It's unveiling God's plan of redemption, showing us what He is doing. And so I try to pull out specific things in each book that I think are kind of unique to that book. Unveil or reveal or teach us something about God's purpose of redemption. So for the book of Ecclesiastes, the first one is this: human wisdom and natural revelation alone are insufficient to reveal the meaning of life. The exhaustive investigation of the preacher in Ecclesiastes puts human intelligence and effort to the test, and ultimately both are found to be completely incapable of unraveling the complexities of life under the sun on their own. Meaning and purpose in life must arise from somewhere beyond the confines of this brief existence. And the preacher addresses this very thing in Ecclesiastes 3:11. We read part of this earlier. He has made everything beautiful in its time. Also, he has put eternity into man's heart, yet so that he cannot find out what God has done from the beginning to the end. This verse, and indeed the argument of Ecclesiastes as a whole, is clear on one thing. Natural revelation and mere human wisdom are unable to satisfy the search for ultimate meaning and purpose in life. But this failure does not leave us without hope. Instead, it anticipates the need for special revelation. If meaning is not found within ourselves, if meaning is not found simply within this life under the sun, then it must come from something beyond us. And this hope finds its ultimate fulfillment in the person of Jesus Christ. For He alone makes the Father known. John 1:18, for no one has ever seen God, the only God who is at the Father's side, He has made Him known. So that search for transcendent understanding and meaning causes us to look outside of ourselves, to look to God for meaning and purpose. And who is the greatest expression, the clearest expression of the Father, the one who reveals Him most perfectly and clearly to us, is the Lord Jesus Christ in His incarnation, in His teaching. And so in that sense, Jesus is the ultimate revelation that Ecclesiastes anticipates. It anticipates it in the sense of saying we must look to God, and then Jesus comes as the fulfillment of the one who is the clearest picture of the Father. The second way that redemption is revealed in Ecclesiastes is true satisfaction and meaning in life cannot be found apart from God. So it points us to our need for a Savior. It points us to our need for a relationship with God. The fact that God has, as we just read, placed eternity in the heart of man means that the temporal things of this life cannot truly satisfy. For every man living under the sun, this temporary mortal life is not the end of existence. Everyone will live somewhere forever. We are created as eternal beings, and our life here under the sun is only a part of our eternal existence. And so because of this, true satisfaction can never be found in temporary things, but only in the infinite and eternal God. And the more one strives to find meaning and purpose in this brief mortal life, the more he'll end up cutting himself off from the only one who can fulfill that longing. So, to quote Michael Barrett in his Old Testament introduction, living under the sun requires looking beyond the sun. Requires us to look outside of this life to something else. And do not misunderstand by that. I don't mean that this life is merely a waiting room for eternity. Instead, this life under the sun is better thought of as a schoolroom. Ecclesiastes 7:14, in the day of prosperity be joyful, in the day of adversity consider, God has made the one as well as the other, so that man may not find out anything that will be after him. This verse makes clear that God sovereignly gives us both good and bad days in this life. And his purpose in doing this is not to punish us or to confuse us, but rather to bring us to the end of our own wisdom and our own devices so that we will turn to him to find true satisfaction and meaning. And this reality is summed up very well in the famous quote, most of you probably know it, by Augustine. He said, "You have made us for yourself, and our heart is restless until it comes to rest in you." Perhaps Augustine did a better job than me of summarizing the book of Ecclesiastes. He did it in a sentence. It wasn't necessarily what he was intending to do, but I think that's a good summary. The third and final one we'll look at this morning, the way that redemption is revealed in Ecclesiastes, is this. Ecclesiastes' conclusion anticipates a need which only the gospel can satisfy. So the concluding verses of Ecclesiastes, at the end of chapter 12 there, echo a summary, the sentence. They're basically a summary of the Mosaic Covenant, right? Fear God, keep his commandments. Or as it's stated in the Torah, do this and live, right? That's it. Fear the Lord God, keep his commandments. That's the path to life. Do what's commanded and live. But the difficulty, however, is how do we accomplish that? The entirety of Old Testament revelation that we've been looking at and on through the Old Testament clearly shows that fallen man is incapable of doing those two things either perfectly or consistently. The one thing that man can't seem to get down is how to fear God and how to keep his commandments. Indeed, Ecclesiastes ends with a demand to do these things, but it does not resolve the problem of how fallen men can meet such a demand. And this glaring omission is not an oversight, but rather it is an intentional signpost placed here by the divine author, pointing us forward to the need for a new covenant. Because to perfectly fulfill Ecclesiastes' demands, we would need access to perfect righteousness, we would need God's law written on our hearts, and we would need true obedience that flows from a regenerated will. In other words, we would need what can only be found in the gospel of Jesus Christ. And so in order to fulfill the closing prescription of Ecclesiastes, we need the gospel. We need the work of the Spirit, that new life, taking out a heart of stone, giving us a heart of flesh, changing our desires and our will, transforming our minds. We need that work done by the Spirit so that we can fear God and keep his commandments, so that we can love the Lord with all our heart, soul, mind, and strength. So in conclusion, the purpose of Ecclesiastes in the Bible's big story is to answer the timeless question that arises in the heart of every human being. What is the meaning of life? As divine image bearers, we were created to be in right relationship with God. Ecclesiastes also points us forward to the only solution to that longing, a covenant relationship with God made possible by the sacrificial work of Jesus. And we will only find true fulfillment with Christ at the center of our life. He alone is the answer to the question that Ecclesiastes raises, and it's in Him alone that its fulfillment is found.